Okay, this is Amit Hazan. Thanks, and welcome to our next podcast in the series we've been doing here at Puma Venture Capital. And we're really excited for this one in particular. This is the story of Capstan Medical, and that's the first investment that we made at Puma Venture Capital. So it is and will always be one that is memorable and important to us. And we have with us for this podcast, Dan Wallace. Dan was the co-founder of Capstan, and he's got an incredible story to tell about his own life and career and how we got to this point with Capstan. And so with no further ado, Dan, welcome to our podcast feed.
Thank you, Amit. It's always fun to talk to you.
Well, I appreciate that. And, you know, I thought, Dan, what we could do is talk about you a little bit and your background and history, because it's so fascinating that, you know, it is an important part of how we tell the Capstan story and obviously for you and the importance of you in this story. So let's start from the early days. You know, tell us a little bit about, you know, where you grew up, where you went to school, and how you got into robotics from being a medical professional.
Okay, yeah. So I grew up in Reno, Nevada, which felt like the middle of nowhere when I was growing up. Both my parents were teachers. My mother was a high school teacher, and my father's a psychology professor at the University of Nevada. I wanted to try something outside of Reno, and so I went to Rice University and studied mechanical engineering in Houston, Texas. And I've always loved airplanes and spacecraft, and so was lucky enough to get a position in mission control working on the space shuttle as a flight controller in Houston out of school. And a few years of that was a wonderful job. I loved it. But I started thinking about medical devices a lot. And it was a time when minimally invasive surgery was kind of just starting. It was just coming from orthopedics and gynecology into general surgery. And I got so fascinated by that. I went back to school on the West Coast at Stanford to try to start focusing on both mechanical design and the design of minimally invasive surgical instruments to try to make surgery less painful. And started working with a group called Origin Med Systems in 1991, designing basic instruments for general laparoscopy. So things like trocars and clip appliers and staplers. We designed balloons for dissecting layers of tissue so that you could do hernias in a less invasive way. And that's how I really ended up starting to get into medical device design.
Yeah. And so walk us through how that led you to working with Intuitive Surgical.
Well, part of our, at Origin Med Systems, we had an interesting team. I think a group of people who've really been successful in medical devices in both the venture and design worlds. And one thing that we did at Origin was we had a formalized way of looking for new technologies. I think they called it the technology acquisition group or something like that. We would have a tags meeting once a month where we would look at new things. And we were tasked with bringing things into that meeting. And I was working closely with a general surgeon by training named Fred Mall. And I just had this passion of working next to him in the animal lab. So I, you know, designed something and try to get it into testing it in surgery with him every other week. And developing that relationship, Fred had seen a armored personnel carrier nearby in Menlo Park, California, that had been, I think, commissioned by Dr. Satava to show that, you know, the concept that you could put a open robotic surgery system in an armored personnel carrier, drive it up to the front lines, and have a surgeon operating it to do battlefield surgery from a safe location further away from the front lines. And that concept, Fred showed me at SRI in Menlo Park. And it was really fascinating to me because, first of all, it's this really cool machine in an armored personnel carrier, which is kind of neat. But I think Fred saw something in it. I mean, when I first saw it, I thought, okay, well, it's open surgery. I'm not as interested in that. I couldn't quite see the application. And then Fred said, you know, imagine making this laparoscopic. And I thought, oh, that's cool. You know, you could use the robot so you don't have to move opposite directions, because in laparoscopic surgery, your body wall acts as a pivot. So, you know, with a manual instrument, you move your hand down to move the tip of the instrument up in the patient's body. And so not reversing those motions started to become interesting. And then Fred looked at me and said, imagine if you put a wrist on it, it would be like having your hands back inside the patient. And that's what every surgeon wants. And that's where it just kind of blew up my mind. And Fred turned to me and said, you know, can you design the wrist? And I thought,
easy task.
The coolest thing I've ever done, right? And so that's how we started working on it. And Fred went out and raised the money, and I started thinking about how to design a wrist, both in, you know, the complexities of making it work in the sizes that we wanted, you know, in a 5 to 8 millimeter instrument, but also trying to figure out, you know, was it reusable? Was it disposable? Was it reprocessable? How would you create an economically feasible design? And a lot of our early work went into, like, how do you make it as easy to change as a normal tool in laparoscopy? How do you make it so that it doesn't add very much to the procedure cost? You know, that was all unknown to us at the time. And so designing what became the EndoWrist for the Da Vinci system, was one of the most fascinating projects of my life.
Yeah, I mean, I think about it now looking back, and, you know, it feels to me like that's one of the most important technologies, you know, that the Da Vinci robot has on it. You know, as I think about all the different aspects of the robot, did you know at the time that this was going to be, you know, potentially incredibly pivotal in the success, likelihood of success of the robot?
Yes and no. I mean, I think I was so fascinated by it and so passionate about it and so focused on it, but we had so many hard problems in designing that system, you know, controls problems, algorithmic problems. You know, none of us, I think, knew that the system that supported the robotic arms was going to be so hard. And I think everybody who's followed in that path has probably followed in underestimating the complexity of what we call the setup joints, the system that supports the robotic system. And so, I you know, it's interesting. Different things have different levels of visibility. I think because the instruments are right in your field of view and in your eyes, they get in some ways the most attention. And if you have problems, that's often where they show up, because it's the most visible component. But there were so many aspects where, you know, what an amazing team over the years to be able to solve so many complex problems. And I think the fact that, you know, there's still competitors are just starting to arrive after, you know, 25 years shows how hard it was.
Yeah. That complexity comment really sticks with me, having watched this field develop over 20 plus years, how challenging it really has been. And so for you, how long did you stay with Intuitive, and where'd you go next?
Yeah, so I was there, I think it was 6 or 7 years, I want to say. And then Intuitive really, and it was absolutely the right thing to do. I think the leadership team at Intuitive said, you know, we have a base technology, we have a foundation, and now we need to refine it and sell it. And I've always kind of moved a little more towards the innovation side. And so I think, you know, Fred, Rob Young, who was the kind of technical founder of Intuitive, and I started looking for what's the next least invasive thing we can do, and started trying to figure out ways to use, you know, the lumens of the body to get to surgical targets. And so we started thinking about working inside the heart and controlling things inside the heart. And we looked at the treatment of atrial fibrillation. And I think we'd had some friends who had atrial fibrillation, and we saw how difficult life could be, either getting an open heart procedure or, you know, trying to manage, you know, blood thinners like warfarin into your daily life. And so we started thinking about, okay, well, you know, treating atrial fibrillation with a catheter is really surgery from the inside out. You're trying to create a scar inside the heart that blocks the aberrant kind of signals that are causing the arrhythmias. And that requires precision and control and good contact with the tissue, but not too much contact with the tissue. And so it was a really complex surgical problem being done with kind of floppy, long catheters. And we thought we could really, you know, improve using kind of robotic algorithms. We could improve those procedures. And so we started working on what now is probably called flexible robotics, ways of controlling flexible devices that go through long lumens in the body into up to a surgical site. And that's when we really started doing kind of surgery from the inside out, with the benefit of robotic control.
Yeah. So this was Hanson?
This was a place called Hanson Medical. We called it Hanson Medical because we were all arguing about what we should call it. And we were on Hanson Way, which is where we started Intuitive Surgical. And so to stop arguing with each other about what to name the company, we just named it after the street that the Intuitive was started on and that Hanson Medical was started on.
And so my recollection, Hanson IPOs around 2006 or so.
Yeah.
Are you still with them at that time, or when did you move on from Hanson?
Yeah, I think I moved on from Hanson around 2009 or 2010. So we powered through that IPO. We had a good IPO and some good sales. I think we, you know, looking back, and you want to learn from your experiences, I think we had some great technologies. It was about the time that Intuitive started taking off as well. And I think our team, we looked at it and were pressured to try to match Intuitive's sales growth, and probably installed more than we trained. And so had a robotic system that needed support and training, but probably we got ahead of ourselves in installations and undertrained our teams. And so didn't have the people using the system as much as I think they could have. But, you know, looking back, I think that technology, you know, Auris bought Hanson Medical's technologies, and I think you'll probably see those technologies in their lung treatment system now. And so even though the company isn't treating people for atrial fibrillation and vascular disease right now, its technologies are being used in the lungs with the Monarch system at Auris, and have been kind of the ground, the foundation for building the next layer of kind of flexible robotic control for cardiac surgery and cardiology.
Yeah, so that gets you some exposure to cardiology, some lessons learned, as you said, and technology lives on in different indications. So from Hansen, where do you go? Is this where you end up at Oris, or did you have a stop in between?
Well, I think it was a little bit of both. I worked on a surgical navigation system in a very small company that I called Translucent Medical. The idea there was, it was, I think, before we were calling things augmented reality, but it was trying to get, I'd seen over and over that surgeons had great preoperative CTs, but it was difficult to visualize slice by slice what you wanted to see and reference during a procedure. And so we took preoperative CTs, segmented them into 3D images, and then presented them away in a way aligned over the patient on a screen that if you move the screen, you could look at, it was like looking through the screen into the patient to see the anatomy from your CT projected over your surgical site. It was kind of a way to get really intuitive based 3D navigation views into the surgical suite, and ended up bringing that technology. Oris ended up buying that technology as well. And as part of that deal, I started working a day or two at Oris, but at the same time was excited about developing a transcatheter mitral valve replacement, and put a team together in Santa Cruz, California, to develop one of what I would call the first generation transcatheter mitral valve replacement devices. It was a company called Sophia, ended up being bought by Abbott Vascular, and it's a transcatheter mitral valve replacement that's in clinical trials right now, internationally and in the United States. Learned a lot about minimally invasive mitral valve repair and replacement, and also about designing and developing what are essentially massive nitinol stents, you know, like stents of a scale that had probably been unheard of before.
Right. Right. So you've got early days of TAVR at that time, and it was going, you know, well, but early, and the data looked really good. I'm curious what drew you to the mitral valve replace space.
Well, I think it's largely because it's such an unmet need. I mean, I think MitraClip has been wonderful in how many people they've helped, but it's not the ideal repair that surgeons would choose to do. And I think as my parents aged and my parents' friends aged, I saw so many people who would suffer from some level of minor heart disease, structural heart disease, that would get worse and worse through the years because the treatment was so severe. You know, having your chest cracked and your heart stopped and going on pump, you know, I just felt like, at least anecdotally, I was seeing so many people who could get treatment who weren't until it was too late. And then they were, it was beyond the time where you could maybe treat them through an open procedure. And then, you know, you look at the numbers, and the numbers seem to reflect that. There are so many people who suffer from cardiac valve disease in the tricuspid and mitral space who go untreated for too long. And yeah. So I saw this opportunity. You know, if you can make it less invasive, it fits into what I've been trying to do this whole, you know, my whole career, is make things less invasive and get people treatment in a less expensive way and less painful and less dangerous way. And mitral repair and replacement seems so ripe for that still.
Yeah. And this is kind of where, you know, hard to say with just what we just went through and the richness of your career, to say that that's where things pivoted and really evolved into this capstan story, where you take your robotic experience and successes and marry that with your structural heart experience and overall cardiology experience and successes. And, you know, 2019, as you say, that Sophia gets sold to Abbott. And then by 2020, if I'm not mistaken, you're already in early stages of developing Capstan and applying, both robotic, everything that you've had in your career to this one company and one design of a product that will take advantage of both. Was that when you were at Sophia? I imagine you could have done the same thing. Maybe just give us a word on, why it wasn't the right time then and why it is the right time now to incorporate robotics into the valve implantation process.
Yeah, I mean, it was something that like popped into your, popped into our heads probably doing the first generation valve design where, I don't think we set out to make things robotic for the sake of making them robotic. And I think at Sophia, you start to see this, okay, I have, four or five knobs on this delivery system. Well, geez, a robot makes handling four or five knobs with two hands a lot easier because the computer integrates the motions between the knobs. You start to see that hint. But in that first generation of valve and delivery system design, we were so far away from kind of being able to refine the procedure to that point that it didn't become obvious. And in fact, it was such a funny story coming out of that design. After we transacted to Abbott, we had a team that was one of the best teams, probably the best team I've ever worked with, that suddenly didn't have anything to do. And we popped our heads up and said, okay, number one, we want to work together again. A bunch of generalists who are really good at a lot of different things in the medical field. We just wanted to work together again. And then the second thing we said is we definitely don't want to work on another valve, because we were kind of spent and kind of sick of it. But after a month or two of talking together and spending time together and trying to decide where to put our efforts, we became so passionate about making mitral valve repair and replacement better that we started drifting back into it and felt like the first generation of transcatheter mitral valve replacements took such a huge leap forward. But there were still problems that we felt, designing a valve and a delivery system together in an integrated way would address. Designing the valve with some knowledge of the pitfalls of the first generation that we could address. And then, like you've mentioned, wow, we have robotic experience and we have a delivery device where you're trying to do surgery from the inside out. You need all the degrees of motion of real surgery, but nobody can control six or seven or eight knobs with two hands. And that's where the robot really, the computer really helps you.
Yeah. So I want to start to talk about your portfolio of products before, let me just for those who aren't familiar, we probably won't spend too much time on the actual markets and the size of the markets on this call, but just as a reference, if it's helpful to folks that are new to the space, the aortic valve market is the largest in terms of market size. It's probably about a $5 billion market today. And in the US, just for context, in the aortic space, there's probably, roughly speaking, about 80,000 TAVR implants a year. Those are the minimally invasive ones. And then maybe another 50,000 or so, again, just round numbers of surgical valves for aortic per year. And that's a $5 billion market. Just take a look at Edwards and, Edwards Life Sciences and where that company and that stock trades to get a sense of what investors think about this market. It's one of the most exciting markets in medtech, certainly in my coverage of medtech that I've seen in the past decade. And the excitement around the mitral valve is because the prevalence is 2 to 3 times that of aortic, and it has very similar type of dynamics where there is, open heart surgical valve options, but fairly small numbers. And what TAVR, what minimally invasive, did for aortic was open up a lot more patients. And that is the hope, and has been for many years, for mitral, is that we can see that same kind of opening up of that market as we go to minimally invasive procedures. So that's a little bit of context of the market for folks who are new. But then back to your story, you know, let's talk first about the valve and go with, you know, the way you've been describing it. Let's talk about the challenges with the prior kind of, let's call them current devices that are in clinicals, and what your learnings were from Sophia. And then, you know, let's put that the capstan valve into that conversation to see what you developed to overcome some of those challenges that you saw.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the first generation of transcatheter mitral valve replacements, you know, is an amazing step forward. I mean, the products that Medtronic and Abbott and Edwards have solved a huge number of problems. I mean, they prove that it's possible. They prove that, you know, you can retain a valve against the high pressures of the left ventricle without it popping out into the atrium, and that you can deliver them most of the time in a reasonable way without complications. I mean, so a huge, huge step forward in the development of these products, but they have faced issues. And one of the issues is they aren't treating as many patients as we had hoped. And so that is what we would call inclusion criteria being poor. And so I think across these valves, you see, you know, maybe 70, maybe 80% of the people that you would want to treat are being excluded. And therefore, you know, sometimes anatomical and geometrical considerations, like how the valve fits in the heart, and whether, you know, basically a lot of these valves, in order to have enough structure to stay in place against the pressures in the heart, they may block the outflow through the heart. And so, you know, they may actually physically block where the blood flows from the left ventricle into the aorta. And that's a big problem. Some of them are relatively stiff, and they tend to almost, you know, paralyze the ventricle or reduce its ability to contract and force blood out. And there are some problems just, you know, in delivering, in a lot of companies, you know, you have a delivery team and an implant team, and the two may not talk all that frequently. You know, designing the two together and to work under control together. You know, these are large structures made of a super elastic material called nitinol. It's an amazing material. You can pack it very small and it'll expand to be very large, but it's a big spring. And when you unpack it, sometimes it releases all that spring energy in one big jump. And so, you know, you want to design your delivery system and your valve to work together so that when you unpack it, it doesn't spring out of place. It stays exactly where you put it. And so in some ways, what I'm describing is you're combining valve design that includes more patients by fitting into the heart in a better way, not blocking the outflow tract and being compliant enough to work with a heartbeat. And you're designing a delivery system that works with that valve, so that you can position it very carefully in the right place. And then as you release it, it stays there. It doesn't move during the release process. And it all has to be small enough, you know, so that you don't cause vascular complications trying to put a big device into somebody's vein and up into the heart. And doing all those things together, that's where, you know, a really well-integrated team comes into play. And we have such a great team of delivery and valve people kind of thinking the same way together, to design a device that can work under control, include a lot more patients, treat a lot more patients, and be consistent and reliable so that a lot more physicians can treat those patients. And that's also where the robot comes into play, is the robot simplifies the procedure rather than making it more complicated. and gives you more control over putting the valve in exactly the right place.
Yeah, there's a lot there to unpack. Let's talk a little bit more about the valve first and just anchoring. That's another big problem with existing mitral valve replacement products. And I'm curious if you can maybe just spend a minute to explain, you know, the architecture of the capstan valve and how it kind of, you know, tries to overcome that issue.
Yeah, and, you know, first of all, I think, you know, valves of this nature fall into probably two categories. People are doing what we call two-part anchoring, where they put a ring or a cable or something in place and then deliver the valve into it. And then there's one-part anchoring devices where you essentially have a spring structure that flares in the ventricle. And it's kind of like a champagne cork is how people describe it, so that it flares open into the ventricle and you have little tiny barbs that engage the tissue and help the valve stay in place. So we're probably doing more of the latter construct, where we have a very soft spring structure, you know, kind of flared champagne cork that opens in the ventricle, but it doesn't open very far in the ventricle, and so that we don't block the outflow tract. And most of the structure that supports the leaflets of the valve is more towards the atrium. And, you know, so it sits a little high, doesn't block the outflow tract, doesn't paralyze the heart, but still gives us enough space to seal so that we don't leak, so that the valve doesn't leak, and that you have good flow characteristics, because you still want, you know, blood to flow from the atrium to the ventricle very smoothly. Whenever you have poor flow, that's, you know, creates little eddies or cul-de-sacs that can potentially create clots. And so you're designing a very, you know, you want a smooth pipe, and you want it to be situated more towards the atrium so that it doesn't block flow out of the ventricle. And we created a way of doing that is kind of a one-piece structure that sits in the ventricle and supports the valve structure very beautifully. And creates a nice hemodynamic flow pattern from the atrium into the ventricle.
Yeah, that's a great point, and one, as you say, is so important for patient inclusion. And then on the delivery catheters, we really start to think about, you know, optimizing valve placement, and, you know, your decoupling of, you know, kind of unsheathing and valve deployment, I think, is, you know, this really nice story. Do you want to spend a minute on just elaborating a little bit on how that works and ties into the capstan name, perhaps? And why that's so unique here and important for, you know, being able to position the valve correctly.
Yeah, and I think I'll give you a little background on that. And I mean, I think it comes from working in surgery rather than cardiology, to tell you the truth. When you work with cardiac surgeons and general surgeons, you know, surgeons always want everything to be under perfect control. And, you know, you never really would toss something into the heart, or, you know, you do things every moment under control. And I think what we saw in this first generation is there was a moment where, you know, most of the procedure you were under control, you're manipulating your valve and your delivery system into place while the valve was still compressed. But then when you went to unsheath, you'd get this moment of things being out of control where the valve would pop out. And we really wanted to go back to what surgeons have always taught me, which is every second of surgery, things should be under control. And so we started out with asking ourselves, how do we maintain control at the moment of deployment? And if you maintain control at that moment, you can also adjust your position and adjust your your control at that moment. And so what we did was we started thinking about how we could wind and unwind a valve rather than have it pop out. And so we have a very simple system of essentially sutures that wrap around the valve. And then we have a capstan in the middle of our delivery system that winds those sutures up and then unwinds them for deployment. And it has to be very, very simple because everything has to work every single time. And so the company we called Capstan, partly because we're engineers and we're not good at naming things, there's probably better names we could have come up with, but we called it Capstan because that describes the function of our device. That like a capstan on a sailboat that winds your sails in and out, we have a capstan down the center of our delivery system that carefully winds and unwinds the valve. So you can adjust the position at any time. You're always in control. And that was the core of our design and development. And that's why we named the company that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. And you know, back to kind of thinking about the delivery catheters and this idea of patient inclusion, you know, vascular access becomes another kind of point of differentiation. Do you want to talk about for a minute, you know, which direction you went with that in transfemoral and what others are doing and the size of your catheters and what that might mean for competitive advantage?
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think what we found after the first generation of valve design is that coming up the femoral vein is least invasive for the patient and best for the patient's heart. And so what this procedure does is you come up the venous side, which, you know, come up the femoral vein into the right atrium. And from the right atrium, we poke a hole between the right atrium and the left atrium to cross into the left heart and deliver the mitral valve. That hole tends to heal pretty well. I mean, I think the way I think about it is when you're in your mother's womb, that hole is open. There's a hole there to pass blood back and forth. And it's a place in your body that is kind of designed to close and heal. And so you can poke a 10 millimeter hole in that place in the heart, and it will heal. Most of the time it'll heal right up. And I think that provides kind of our limit, you know, to pass through the femoral vein, you kind of need to be, you know, 10 millimeters or less in diameter. So 1 centimeter or less in diameter, and to pass through that hole in the heart. Now, some of the first devices are larger than that, and you do get some complications or maybe some people you can't include because their veins are too small. And so you want to be small, smaller than, you know, 10 millimeters or less if you can, so that you don't, you know, you're minimizing trauma to people and including as many people as possible. I think some of the early designs came through the apex, the point of the ventricle. And I think what you find out there is, you know, if somebody is sick enough to need heart surgery of this sort, their ventricle doesn't maybe really have the power to accommodate a big hole poked through it. And so I wanted to stay away from that, you know, both in terms of minimizing the trauma to the patient and also maximizing the chances of success of the procedure.
Yeah, and I'd say, you know, important to recall that in TAVR, transfemoral was by far, you know, wanted by both surgeons and patients and won out in the end. And that as we think about the competitive landscape, there are some leading companies like Abbott who are still going at this with the transapical approach, which I think most would agree is not optimal or as optimal as transfemoral. So So here we are, and this is part of what I love about the story is we've talked about an implant that's differentiated. We've talked about delivery that's differentiated, and we haven't even really talked about the robot yet or the other valves in the story. And so, you know, on top of this, now you have the robot. So you touched on it a little bit earlier, but maybe let's spend a minute or two describing what the robot is going to add to this procedure that is incremental above and beyond what we've already discussed.
Yeah, and I think it's important to chat about it. I mean, in some ways, this is a very, very simple robot. I mean, it's probably 1/10 as complicated as the Da Vinci, but it still adds enormous capabilities to the procedure. And so I think of it, you know, I try to come up with analogies. And one analogy is try to draw a circle with an Etch-a-Sketch using two knobs. That's kind of like what it's like doing surgery with knobs, except in this case, we're working in 3D and we have kind of 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 knobs when you think about all the knobs that are used for positioning and deployment and unsheathing of the device. And so where the robot helps so much is it turns 8 knobs into a joystick, essentially. So you end up with a very simple input for a relatively complex motions. And now it makes the physician's life so much easier and the procedure so much more reliable and efficient that, you know, instead of incrementally adding a little bit to one knob and then adding a little bit to another knob and then taking away a little bit on another knob, you're just driving a robot with the joystick or driving the tip of this catheter with the joystick, and it goes exactly where you want it to go. And it's a very simple robot, but it provides just a huge benefit. And you can think about also, you know, you're not just maybe deploying a mitral valve, you could be using it to deploy and position a tricuspid valve or a mitral repair device, or doing, you know, more complex surgeries inside the heart, because instead of doing it incrementally by turning knobs, you're doing it, you know, just by controlling the tip of the device directly with a joystick.
And so one of the questions I got a lot from investors that I've talked to about the story and folks that know it or have heard about of you is the complexity question. We touched on it at the beginning when you talked about Intuitive and how complex that system was. You talked about it just now about how far less complex this system is. But nonetheless, mitral valve replacement is an incredibly complex area to get right. And robotics has been known to be a complex area to get right. How do you feel about, you know, kind of how, you know, the two stacking together, how much of a challenge this is? You've taken on a big challenge with these two key aspects for you to get this right and to be able to meet your milestones and, you know, to do this on a timeline that, you know, you feel good about. You know, how give us a sense of how challenging this is, integrating both of these aspects of the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably it is challenging. I don't want to minimize that challenge, but it also is, it's simpler than a Da Vinci, and we've done a Da Vinci before. You know, I worked on that before, and it is, you know, it's simple in the fact that the robot isn't added to be just for fun. You know, it's added to make the procedure simpler. And I think it's all about your team. We have a team that has done this before. You know, we have clinical engineers who've done robotic cardiac surgery before, robotic cardiology before, and have worked on replacement mitral valves before. And so in a lot of ways, I guess it seems hard, but it's stuff we've done before. All of us have done before. And so it's not that hard. You know, you're pulling a lot of pieces together, but they're very familiar pieces. And so I'm very confident about it. There are a lot of ways a lot of things we have to keep on track and be disciplined about, but it's all elements that we've done before.
Okay. Good to hear. Certainly for us as investors. And I think I wanted to kind of ask you what you're able to say publicly about just the timelines as we kind of close up the mitral valve replace part of the story.
Yeah. I mean, I love driving to aggressive timelines. And in fact, I have this kind of personal belief that it's far better to drive to an aggressive timeline and miss 10% than it is to drive to a soft timeline and make it perfectly. I think you always come out ahead driving aggressively. And so we're driving our team to be doing implants in humans around this time next year. And, we want to be driving to implants in humans by the end of 2024. That's what we drive our team to. Now, I'm giving you information that's how I drive a team. And, we may miss that by 10%, but that's what we're going to drive to. And so I think that puts us, in a good place to be doing human implants in early 2025. But I know I'm saying in a weird way, I'm driving the team to be doing humans by the end of 2024 and having our system ready to do that.
Okay. So let's kind of close that part of the story up and just spend a couple minutes before we go on tricuspid and mitral repair. And we don't have to get into as much detail here, but you wanted to tell us a little bit about your portfolio for those valves and, how you'll prioritize between the two and what we should expect to see there.
Yeah. So we're starting with a mitral replacement, a minimally invasive mitral replacement, and the delivery system for that. We are also developing a tricuspid replacement. And we've, taken that into animal work and done benchtop deliveries of that device. That will follow second. And I think that we're following the logic of surgery, which is treat the mitral valve first and treat the tricuspid valve second. And it was kind of how I think the surgeons usually think of it. And we also have kind of some unique intellectual property around a mitral repair device that's similar to, you might say it's similar to MitraClip. But I feel like, both repair and replacement have places to help people and places in this market. And both are important. And so we have both of those systems in our portfolio. And I think in our portfolio, the robotic computer control helps with all of these devices.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I think for this conversation, that's a lot of information to take in. And it was great, Dan, to just have a conversation with you about your career, as incredible as it's been, and how the journey continues with this story, and I and the team at Puma are so excited to be a part of it now, of the journey, and see where it turns out, and are so confident in what you all are doing. And for those listening, as always, thank you so much for listening. And if you have any questions for me or for Dan, let me know and I'll get them answered. And I wish everybody a great rest of the final days of August, summer. And we'll talk to you all soon. And Dan, thanks so much again for the time.
Thank you, Amit. It's always great talking to you. Appreciate it.
Great. Take care, everybody.